there have been great moments in Jewish history. One of the greatest took place a few days before the revelation of Sinai, when God offered the Torah to the Jewish people. That is to say, he sent a message with Moses. I have a Torah, would you like it? And the Jewish people answered with the formula, Na'aser v'nishma, which might be translated, we will do and we will hear. Let's talk about the translation. And the Talmud reports that God was overjoyed with this response. Mi gila levanai raj zeh shemalachei ashores mishtamshim bo, who revealed to my children this secret that the angels use? Gibore Korach, Ose Dvoro, Lishmoa, the Kol Dvoro, it says of the angels, great in strength, doers of his word, to listen to the voice of his word, putting doing before listening, putting doing before hearing. Who revealed to my children this great secret that the angels use? So God was overjoyed with this two-word formula. I suppose that means the two-word formula is pretty important. Probably contains within it some fundamental ideas. Now we will look tonight at four or five different ideas. We're sort of skimming the surface, but for the first time through, it will be enough. And I will stop after each idea, and if there are questions or comments, I'll be glad to take them and get as many in tonight as we can. We will do and we will hear. If we translate it that way, it faces an immediate, obvious difficulty. How can you do what you have not heard? How do you know what to do? There are a number of answers to this question, but maybe the simplest, easiest way out is to recognize that in Hebrew, Lishmoa, this is the biblical Hebrew, Lishmoa means to hear and also to understand. In the Devarim Tavches, in Deuteronomy 28, when it says, we'll be conquered by a nation, Asher lo tishma l'shono, a nation whose language you will not shma, doesn't mean that the nation will communicate by telepathy or hand signals. It means they'll talk and you won't understand. When Joseph's brothers come down to Egypt, just pretending to be an Egyptian, so he's speaking Egyptian, and the brothers are conferring among themselves in front of him, out loud, they didn't know that Yosef was Shomea, because the interpreter is between them. They knew he could hear the sound waves, but they didn't know he understood. So, lishma in biblical Hebrew can mean to understand. Then the formula reads, we will do and we will understand. And the greatness of the idea is putting doing before understanding. And the first question is that reasonable? Is that reasonable to do before you understand? Isn't that a bit rash? Irresponsible? Maybe irrational? After all, there are lots of wrong things in the world, lots of bad things in the world. If you have a mind, especially if you have some education, shouldn't you investigate and understand before you accept the course of action? Why would it be a great praise that we should be prepared to do before we understand? Let me answer the question and I'll take comments. Now, I think here we're not reading our own lives correctly. We're not in touch with what really goes on in our lives. Let me give you a simple analogy. I go to the doctor, I have a checkup, and the doctor says, you're doing okay, but you have a certain condition, and if you don't treat it, it could cause you trouble. Fortunately, it's a well-known condition, and medicine for it is well-established. I'll give you a prescription, go to the pharmacist, take one pill a day for 30 days, and it will cure the condition, you'll be okay. But I take the prescription to the pharmacist, and I hand it to him, and he says, oh yeah, we have this stuff. And then he says, do you mind if I ask you a personal question? And I say, well, you ask, and I'll decide whether I'll answer or not. And he says, you're giving me a prescription for this medicine. Do you know what's in this medicine? Do you know what condition you have? Do you know what it will do to your metabolic system and your nervous system and your blood system when you take this medicine? Have you studied organic chemistry? Do you know what you're doing here? Now, what am I supposed to say? Nope, I don't know any organic chemistry. Nope. The chemicals in the medicine, I don't know what it's going to do to my system. So am I unreasonable? Irrational? Irresponsible? Am I leaping before I look? Is this blind faith? What's going on here? I hope it's obvious. I'm trusting my doctor. I don't have to know personally the detailed reason for everything I do. Indeed, to tell you the truth, I don't want to know. I'm not interested in learning medicine. I have enough time and challenge and interest in learning myself. That's why I'm happy there are doctors. They can memorize hundreds of organic molecules if they like. They get a charge out of that. Let them do it. I will pay them for the services so that I can get on with the business of my life. It's enough for me that the information comes, or better, the direction comes, from a source that does know the medicine. That's enough. If I have a source that's a trustworthy source, then I don't have to know the reason in detail. And this is what Nasa Vinishma says. Nasa Vinishma says, if it's coming from the creator of the universe, that's even more trustworthy than your doctor. Hard to imagine, perhaps, but that's the facts. And more trustworthy than your investment counselor, and more trustworthy than your lawyer, and more trustworthy than your auto mechanic. And therefore, it is appropriate to be prepared to do, even though I do not personally know the detailed reason for what I'm doing, because it comes from a source that is credible and worthy of trust. So that's the first element, recognizing God's worthiness of trust by saying I'm prepared to do before I know for myself the particular reason for what I'm doing. First item. Questions up to here. All set? Second idea is, it says, Nasa Vinishma. We are committing ourselves to understand. It's not enough just to do. Yes, I'm prepared to do before I understand. But really, it is an additional responsibility to understand. And the reasons are laid out. Many reasons are laid out. For every commandment, there are at least some reasons. No reasons are blank. I'm sorry, no commandments are blank. There's a book called Sefer HaChinuch that goes through all 613 commandments and gives reasons for every one. The other sages that give other reasons. Maybe we don't exhaust the reasons for our mitzvah, but we do have some reasons, and we are required to study, to analyze, and to acquire as much understanding as we are able, so that we don't just do it blind. So the first point is a point about order. Doing can come before understanding. It is not a point about doing without understanding perfectly or belittling understanding. It's just a question of order. A great deal of Jewish scholarship is invested in understanding the reasons that go behind the commandments. Maimonides says in at least two places that we are obligated, ra'ui, it's appropriate for every Jew, to try his best to understand the reasons for the commandments. And I think there's a fairly deep philosophical point here. Why? Why should it be a responsibility to analyze and try to understand the reasons for the commandments. But imagine a person who says, listen, you're the creator of the universe. He told me to put on leather boxes in the morning. I'm willing to obey. I'm obedient. You have the authority to tell me. I trust you there's something in it, and I'm putting them on. What do I lose if I don't analyze the meaning of the commandment? Okay, if I train them to be obedient, if it was enough for me, maybe it'll be enough for them. Maybe. I think there's something more, there's something for the person himself here that's really missing out on.
If you believe that.
If I choose to be obedient, and of course people can choose to be disobedient, it happens quite regularly. I suppose choosing to be obedient is still an exercise of my free will, even if I don't understand the reason. Right?
A lot of rebellion is tied to the understanding.
Say again?
A lot of the value of it is tied to the understanding.
Oh, and why? Why is the value tied to the understanding?
How can you understand it? How can you affirm it? You have to say because the ignorance is compared to the way you understand it.
You're right. You're right. You have the right idea. So I want to put it in different vocabulary, but I think you have the right idea. Let me tell you a story from ancient history. In the 1960s, when we were all protesting the Vietnam War, sitting down in streets and stopping traffic and taking over buildings and things like that, there was a great debate what to do about the protesters. And some people felt that you have to call out the National Guard with bayonets and beat them up and put them in jail. Those who were in favor of a strong, violent response were two groups. Two groups were in favor of calling out the state troopers with the bayonets. One group were the arch-conservatives, beat them up, put them in jail, and put it down. And the other were the arch-radicals who said, you call it the state troopers, and there are clashes in the streets, and that will trigger the revolution and overthrow the government. Now, here you are in the town council, or at the state legislature, and the motion comes up. Shall we call out the state troopers? All those in favor, raise your hands. And 52 hands go up. 30 of them are trying to protect the government, and 22 are trying to pull the government down. And their hands all go up at the same time. You cannot tell from the motion of the hand what the action is. A human action is not the motion of a body. A human action is the expression of an idea and of a value in the motion of a body. That's why novels spend very little time talking about what the body does and a lot of time talking about what the person thinks and what the person feels and his inner voice is going back and forth. Because what makes it human is that it's not a horse moving, it's not a squirrel moving, it's a person with a mind, it's a person with feelings, it's a person with values. The motion of the body is important because it expresses the mind, the feelings, and the values. The same bodily motion can express very different actions, depending upon the mind and the feelings behind it. Now, a person who says, you told me to, I'm doing it. But as far as investigating it, I'm not interested. How much of him is in the action? What is he investing in the action? What is his body expressing in the action? Well, it's expressing his will. It's expressing his obedience, his recognition of God as authority, period. What's about the rest of his brain? The rest of his brain is on holiday. Or it's thinking about other things. His brain is not online. His mind is not online. It's not participating in the action. That means the action is less fully human because less of his humanity is involved in the action. And that's why it's a less valuable action. True, if you do it out of obedience, you do it and you're satisfied it, you'll get credit for it. But you'll get much more credit the more of you that is in the action. And since your mind is an important part of you, if you put your mind into the action, you get more credit for it. That's why studying the meanings of the commandments is itself a responsibility. Na'aseh v'nishma, we will do and we will understand. That's point number two. Questions up to here.
I believe there's a sort of
There is a set of commandments called chok. Chok is sometimes described as a commandment without a reason. Most authorities say it means it's a commandment without an obvious reason. But even for them, as I told you, the Sefer HaChinuch goes through all 613, including Kashrut, and gives reasons on some level or other. Maybe we don't know the ultimate reason. Even the one which is supposed to be the hardest of all, which is the Parah Adum, the red heifer, where some parts of the procedure is designed to make tummy people tohar, to purify them, and yet some parts of the procedure make tohar people tummy. And the question is how one thing could have opposite effects. Even that, Midrash says, Moses understood. And when the Mashiach comes, we'll all understand. We, in our present condition, are not able to, we can't access that information. It's not that the information doesn't exist. It's a matter of access. It's not a matter of its being non-existent. So they all do have reasons. The question is how much we can get. So that's the second idea in Asa Mishnah. The third idea is we will do in order to understand. Some understanding only comes from doing. Some understanding is only experiential. If you don't experience it, then there's no way that you're going to appreciate it. I don't know, any of you know what a sitar is? See, if you have white hairs, you remember the 60s, you know what a sitar is. Yes, where does it come from?
India.
Yeah, good for you. How many strings does it have?
10 or more.
12, I think. Good, good. And what is the difference between Indian sitar music and Western music, the chief difference?
Western music sounds better.
No embarrassment at all. No embarrassment at all. Indian music is based on quarter tones, and ours is based on half tones, which means the spaces between their tones are just half as big as ours, which means you have to listen very, very carefully. Sitar music, most of it is based on a form called the raga form. And the raga form works like this. You have a theme, which is 64 beats long, and the sitar plays the 64 beats, the theme. And if you're used to this, you listen to it, and you sort of get it. And then what happens is you repeat 64 beats over and over again, but each time you repeat, you stretch and compress the theme into a different shape. In other words, I could take the first half of the theme and play it in 10 beats. Maybe the other get 32. But I could squeeze it into 10 beats. And then I would have 54 beats to stretch out the second half of the theme. So you'd hear half of it go by in a whiz, and then the rest of it dragged out over the rest, and you can vary it that way. And that makes it very interesting to the listener, how's he going to do it? Especially if you take a long time for the first half, and you have very little left for the rest, how's he going to fit it all into the end? How's he going to make it sound? And then they manage to do it, and they go over and over like that, 64, 64, 64, 64. Okay, now I've described this to you. You can do the physics of the sitar. You can analyze the tones and the higher tones that are built in. That you haven't heard yet. And you will not understand sitar music until you hear it. All you've got is a verbal description. That's not the same as hearing the music. So there are things in life which, from a verbal description, you cannot possibly understand. The third meaning in we will do and we will understand is we will do in order to be able to understand. Much of the Torah can be understood only together with an experiential component. A person who says, I don't do anything until I understand it, means that most of life he'll never understand, and then he won't do it. Imagine if a person says, I won't go skiing until I understand. He's never going to put on skis. You cannot understand skiing by somebody talking to you. The only way you can understand skiing is to put them on and go. And then, when you've had the experience, you go back to the verbal description and you see it in an entirely different light. Many years ago, there was a student at a college in the New England area who came from a non-religious home, and there were no religious Jews on her campus. Somehow she got hold of Diane Grunfeld's book, The Sabbath. This book goes through the 39 categories of forbidden activity on Shabbos and a few other main ideas. She read it, and she told me she was horrified. Just imagine, she said, you can't turn on or off the lights. You can't turn on or off the radio. You can't open your mail. You can't write a letter. You can't make a telephone call. You can't receive a telephone call. You can't take a shower. You can't cook your breakfast. She said, I was sure anybody who kept Shabbos would be obsessive compulsive, neurotic, that when am I going to make the next wrong move? When am I going to violate the next rule? She told me it took her months to get up her courage to keep her first Shabbos. Finally she did. Now she's all alone. No Shabbos meals and no songs and no davening together in shul, no Kriyas HaTorah, the Torah, no, just a negative Shabbos, just normal. And she said, to her surprise, instead of experiencing, I can't do these things, she experienced, I don't have to do these things. In other words, our lives are built on habits. Habits that consistently interrupt us. This is before cell phones. Can you imagine life without cell phones? I'm sure you can. But, can you ignore the cell phone? Can you even turn it off? Are you able to turn it off? How many cell phones go off at concerts? And when they go off, the person runs outside to take the call. Doesn't turn it off. No. Just got to take the call because somebody's calling me. So what? Somebody's calling you? Aren't you allowed to be out of touch for an hour? Can you walk past your mailbox and see letters in it and just walk past and say, I'll take them out tomorrow. I don't want to be bothered by it today. Somebody wrote me a letter. So what? If there's a mail strike, do you run down to the main sorting facility and sort out your mail because you're missing it? No, you say it'll come tomorrow. So it's here now. So what? Leave it there. No. Impossible. She said she felt liberated from the habitual interruptions. And she had time to think. Time to think uninterruptedly. Where am I going? What am I doing with my life? What do I want out of life? Who am I really? And she said it was very precious. And then, and this is the key to the story, then she said, I went back and reread the book. And instead of reading obsessive compulsive rules, I read strategies for producing a very precious state of consciousness. So, without the experience, it's very difficult to appreciate what the rules mean. And therefore, the third meaning of Na'aseh V'Nishma, we will do and we will hear, is we're prepared to do in order to be able to hear and understand, because without it, very often you're not going to be able to understand. You with me so far? Now, I want to take these ideas one step further, and then we'll go on to other meanings. All right, I'm prepared to do without understanding, because I recognize the authority from which it comes. I'm going to try to understand. I'll do in order to be able to understand. What happens if I get an explanation that is really illogical? It's really illogical. It just doesn't make any sense. What happens then? If I haven't heard the explanation yet, so then maybe it's reasonable for me to trust that there will be an explanation. But now I've heard the explanation. It's just not logical. What do I do then? And indeed, this happened once. When God told Abraham to sacrifice his son Isaac, this was totally illogical. It meant killing his son. It meant that God was contradicting his own promise to Abraham. God promised Abraham that Isaac would be his continuation. At this point in his life, Isaac is 37 years old and has no children. So God is contradicting his own promise. So Abraham says, this is really totally illogical. No, if it's totally illogical, then why was he prepared to carry it out? Okay, so I could learn post facto from Abraham's story that you're supposed to do this. You're supposed to carry it out, even if it's totally illogical. But why is that? What's the reason in it. What's the justification for it? Here again, I think that we're not reading our own lives correctly. Suppose I tell you about infinity. Suppose I tell you that there are two infinities, one bigger than the other. Two infinities, one bigger than the other. That should sound very strange. Infinity means it goes on forever. It just keeps going. No, how could there be two infinities? I mean, they're two forever, one further away. I mean, does that make any sense to you? Now, if I tell you that, you might be very skeptical. But suppose I put on a different hat and tell you that I have a PhD in mathematics, mathematical logic, and there's a branch of mathematics called transfinite mathematics, invented by a Jew named Georg Cantor 120 years ago, in which we routinely prove that there are different levels of infinity, some bigger than the other. Suppose you meet me in the university classroom, where I spent 10 years, and I'm teaching a graduate course in transfinite mathematics, and it's the first day's lecture, and you know I have a PhD in the subject, and I tell you that there are different infinities, some bigger than others. What do you say then? I think what you say is, boy, that sounds totally illogical to me. Notice the change in the formula? Now it's not that it's totally illogical, but it sounds totally illogical to me. But if this guy has a PhD in the subject and there are textbooks written on it, there probably is a logic to it that I don't understand. Every judgment that X is totally illogical is made on the basis of my understanding, my education, and my intelligence. And when I hear something that's totally illogical, I still ask myself, am I really in a position to judge? And even if it sounds totally illogical to me, it might still be true if the people who thought it up are bright enough and knowledgeable enough, it might be true even if it's totally illogical to me. I gave this illustration to some of you, but some of you haven't heard it, so I'll repeat it again. If you want to throw a ball, and you want it to go as fast and as far as possible, what do? You take a running start. Take a running start and you throw. How does the running start help? Why will it go faster if you're running when you throw it?
It's already in motion.
You're running, it's already in motion. And when you throw, you're adding to the motion. If you stand still and you throw it, it goes 10 miles an hour. If you're running 5 miles an hour and throw it, it'll go 15 miles an hour. If you shoot a bullet, it goes, 100 miles an hour. If it's going in a train, it's going 60 miles an hour, and you shoot the bullet, so over the ground, it'll go 160 miles an hour. Right. That's the way it is for balls, and that's the way it is for bullets. Now, I tell you, I have something. X. And when you shoot X, it always goes at the same speed. I don't care if you're running towards me, or you're running away from me, or you're standing still. X always goes at the same speed. That's very weird. That is very weird. How come the motion of the source doesn't contribute to the motion of X? It's always going at the same speed. Well, that's what relativity says about light. Relativity says that no matter how fast the source is going, towards you or away from you or standing still, light always goes past you at exactly the same speed. That's just very illogical. But that's the way relativity says the world is. So now when you hear that, do you say, oh, that's illogical, it can't be right? Or do you say, oh, that sounds illogical to me, but that's because I haven't learned relativity yet, because those guys are very smart, and probably what they're saying is reasonable, just I haven't gotten there yet. I hope you say the latter. I don't know about all students today, but I hope you say the latter. And if it sounds illogical to me, it's because I haven't had enough education to appreciate it. Now, I think the same comparison applies here. The Torah, coming ultimately from God, was even smarter than Einstein. Such a thing could be imagined. In Time magazine's Man of the Century, the 20th century, is Albert Einstein. But God's even smarter than Einstein. So if he tells me something, and to me it's totally illogical, the right attitude is, to me it's totally illogical because I'm only me. And my logic has only this much power to it. There is a reason for it, there is an explanation of it, and I'm not yet in a position to appreciate it. So Nasa Vinishma is going to apply even when what I'm being told sounds to me to be totally illogical. I should be prepared to do it because it comes from such a source. In physics, there are cases where some great people will tell you that the effect comes before the cause. The effect comes first and the cause comes later. That really sounds like gobbledygook. The thing's already happened, but what made it happen is happening tomorrow. That really sounds very weird. But Richard Feynman and John Wheeler and others have cases which they interpret that way. So again, the wise person says, these guys are revolving geniuses, they're much smarter than I am. And if they interpret it that way, there has to be some sense to it, even though I can't see what it is. So Nasa Vinishma is taken as seriously as that I'm prepared to do before I understand, I'm prepared to do even if when I hear it I don't understand, because I trust that there is an explanation, and either I haven't heard it yet or I don't have the ability to understand it. Everybody with me up to here? Okay, now let's push one step. Is that window open? Is the window open? No, you may open it up. Yeah, it's very, very close. Imagine somebody comes into a group and he puts a proposition to them. He says, listen, I think we should all do X. What do you say? Now let's say he goes around the room and says, what do you say? What do you say? What do you say? What do you say? Each person, I suppose, will say, I agree or I disagree, and give his reasons. It's very odd that the Jews answered, each one answered, we will do. Why didn't each one answer, I will do? After all, who am I to speak for you? I can pledge allegiance for myself, I can't pledge allegiance for you. How is it that they all answered with a plural formula? Now, you know, if they had a discussion and took a vote and then they all chorused together, that's one thing. But that's not the way the story is told. Moses puts it to them and they answer, we will do.
Because they're all raised to the level of prophets, so they all knew
who he was. That's later. This is before that. Good try. Good try. That's a reasonable answer. But this is 3 days before the revelation of Sinai. They're not yet prophets. Not yet functioning as prophets. This is an ordinary conversation. The mount is not over their heads. The mount is not burning. The shofar is not sounding. This is 3 days before all of that. So Moses is just talking to them. I have a proposition for you, and do you want it or not? And the answer, we will do. There is an intuitive oneness here, an intuitive connection between the people. Each one can sort of, I'm sort of answering like you just without the word prophecy. That's all I'm doing, just taking away the word prophecy. But there's a sense of unity, so that when each one can sort of feel the vibes, as they say, of the people around him. And they can feel the excitement together, and each one can answer in the plural and say, we will do and we will understand. The Torah tells us that unity was a precondition for the revelation of Sinai, that people had to be unified as if they were one person. It's based on a specific verse in the Torah, which really indicates that pretty clearly. And here you see it in the words that they use when they say we. And this illustrates a philosophical idea which is really quite necessary to understand that compact, that covenant that they made at Sinai. Let's ask this question. We're sitting here 11, 12 years later, something like that. So that means that my great, 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 to the nth power, grandfather and grandmother said yes. What does that got to do with me? Why am I related to their agreement? If my father signed a contract to work for General Motors, do I have to work for General Motors? What does it got to do with me? He lives his life, and I live my life. So what has their Nasa Ben Ishma got to do with me? Here there's a crucial idea, but it's an idea that's based on this a special kind of unity. Let's imagine that an American says, there's a treaty with Mexico. This treaty was signed in 1906. I wasn't alive in 1906. I didn't vote for the government that negotiated that treaty or agreed to that treaty. So, I'm not bound by it. It's the American democracy. Democracy means that I vote for my representatives and they make decisions for me. But they weren't my representatives in 1906. So I don't have to keep that law. It's not correct because although I personally wasn't alive in 1906, the same American nation that made the law in 1906 exists today. And I'm part of that same nation. Seeing that I'm part of that same nation, I'm bound by it. Because although we're all separate individual people, we're all parts of the same unified nation. That's the only way you can communicate the agreements made by a group 100 years ago to me today. Otherwise, they had no connection to me today. So similarly, God said, I'm not making a compact with 3 million individual Jews. I'm making a compact with the Jewish nation, of which you 3 million are today's Jews. When they signed on, it's like negotiating a treaty between two nations. When they signed on, it means that it binds the nation, and binds the nation for the future.
And this is not like the other reason you said about the all one person really, all one neshama, like all together really.
Well, it's very interesting. The Midrash does say that we were all there. Right? The question is, in what form were we all there? There were actually 3 million Jews there. Right now. There are about 12 million Jews alive today. If you say, in any sense, that the rest of us were there also, maybe only the souls were there, right? But a soul can't say yes or no. A soul, by itself, has no free will. Right? So, it's not clear why I'd be bound by what they did. And in simpler terms, if my father takes a vow, right, do I have to keep his vow? Obviously not. So, that being the case, these things don't transmit like that. Whatever metaphysics is behind it, responsibilities don't transmit from father to son, from prior generations to later generations, unless it's a national responsibility. It's a national responsibility it transmits. So you have to have that kind of unification of a collective group, like a nation, or like a corporation in business, which has the same structure. Otherwise, you can't communicate it to a later generation. This is level 4. Level 5 is even deeper. And I'll try to communicate this as best I can. Let's go back to that verse that the Talmud brought concerning angels. If you listen carefully to the grammar in the verse, you'll hear that the grammar is not parallel. The grammar is not uniform. And the change in the grammar communicates, this is what I'm telling you now, it's in the previous line of the Rebbe, it communicates a very important idea. It says, Gibore Koach Osei Dvaro Lishmoa Bekol Dvaro. Osei Dvaro means doers of his will. Osei Dvaro, doers of his will. To hear. I'm sorry, doers of his word. Doers of his word, to hear the voice of his word. Doers is a noun. To hear is a verb. Why does the verse shift the grammar? It doesn't have to. The verse could have used two nouns or two verbs. It could have said, Osei dvaro, shom'ei Kol Dvaro, doers, hearers, are going to say it, Lasos Dvaro, Lishmoa, to do and to hear. Why should it say doers as a noun and to hear as a verb? Says the Svarim Rebbe, what's the difference between a noun and a verb? If I say, it is a horse and it runs. What's the difference between saying it is a horse and saying it runs? Saying it's a horse tells me something about its essence, its identity. That's what it is. A verb just tells me what it does. Usually, what it does is not an expression of its essence. Lots of things run other than horses. A horse, the only thing that's a horse is a horse, but cats run, dogs run, people run. So a verb is much more superficial, much less essential than a noun. Here the Torah is telling you, you know what a malach is? You know what an angel is? An angel is a thing that does what God wants. That's what it is. It is a doer of God's word. And then it comes to listen, to hear God's voice because it is a doer. Its identity is a doer, and therefore it listens. It's not just two things that it does. It does God's word and it listens. But it is a doer of God's word. That's what its identity is. And because it has that identity, of course it listens. Otherwise it can't know what to do. And said the son of Rebbe, when we say Nasa Benishma, the Nasa includes the idea of making ourselves into doers of His will, of His word. The difference between us and angels is they don't have free will. Since they don't have free will, they're sort of manufactured that way. They're manufactured to do God's word. We can be self-creative. By exercising free will, we can make ourselves into something. You ask a person why he's a mathematician rather than a violinist, he'll tell you, I chose to learn mathematics. He could have chosen to play the violin, he chose to learn mathematics. He made himself into a mathematician. Other people make themselves into violinists. Here, the goal is to make myself into a doer of His word, so that, like the angels, I will listen to the voice of His word, because that's my essence. That's what I am. That's my identity. It's not just something that I do. It's not just an activity. So this will be the fifth idea in Nasa V'Nishma. There's a challenge to create in myself that identity, and then, from the point of view of that identity, to listen and carry out His word. Are you with me so far? No questions up to here?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me see if I can give you an analogy to make it clearer. You know, there are people who have a passion for medicine. Often, a person applies to medical school and doesn't get in. His whole life goes on hold for a year. Nothing that happens in the interim year means anything. It's not relevant to him. He's wasting time, marking time till next year when he can apply again, because he's got to be a doctor. He's got to be a doctor. Now, you imagine this person gets a medical degree, and he's got a good practice, he's making a good amount of money, and you notice him reading medical journals. You say to him, wow, you must be really conscientious. You have your degree, you have your practice, you're doing well, and you're still reading the journals. And he says to you, you know what? If I didn't have a practice, I'd still be reading the journals. Medicine is what I am. That's what I am. I don't read the medical journals so as to make more money in my practice. That's not how I read the medical journals. I read the medical journals because I am a doctor. I'm a medical person. To me, medicine is my life. That's my life. So that's what we're talking about. Not a person who says, well, you know, there are lots of things to do in life, and one of them is to do mitzvos, so I'll read the handbook, you know, because it's one of the things I want to do. No, it's because that's what I am. I'm a doer of God's will. That's my identity. So I read it, and I read it because that's God's will. There is, on a more mystical level, an answer to the first question, which I will share with you, but I'm warning you, it's on a more mystical level, so I don't know how easily this will, the easy this will be to relate to. How could you say we will do before we hear? How is that possible? Let me tell you a midrash. God told Abraham to sacrifice his son. So he takes him up the mountain, ties him up, puts him on the altar with the wood. And then it says, Vayishlach es yodo vayikas makelos amachos l'shchotus b'no. He stretched out his hand. Literally, he sent out his hand and took the knife, slaughtered his son. Now, what is this sending out your hand? To send out your hand to take the knife. Right? So the Midrash says that his hand didn't want to go. His hand didn't want to go. Because, at the end, God did cancel the order. In the end, God did not want Abraham to kill Isaac. And a tzaddik, a righteous person who was on a high enough level, his body becomes in tune with God's will. And he can more or less feel what needs to be done. So here Abraham was in a quandary. God told me to slaughter him. And my hand is showing resistance. Usually, my body knows by itself what God wants. But here he used his mind to overcome the response of his body. And he said, listen, I don't know about my hand. I don't know what's motivating my hand at the moment. But I have an explicit order. I have to carry it out. So he sent out his hand against the resistance. And overcame the resistance to take the knife. Now, maybe it's possible for a person to so elevate himself, to so purify himself, that his body somehow spontaneously knows what God wanted. And then he could say, we will do before we hear, because really, I don't have to hear. For such a person, hearing an explicit order, thou shalt do X, is not necessary. Because his body already knows what needs to be done. And then he could answer the question directly. You don't have to say that Mishnah means to understand, but it means to hear. And to be able to do before he can hear. You have that on a much lower level in life also. When people respond to new circumstances, crisis circumstances, they respond spontaneously, and the response is a correct response. They don't think out the response. They don't play the response. Sometimes it happens too fast. It happens in sports. It happens in medicine. It happens in war. It's just, there's a flash, and almost by itself, the body moves to do what needs to be done. Because there's a kind of subconscious processing that works much faster than the conscious mind can grasp, and it just happens, and the response is forthcoming. And for certain types of people with certain types of experience, the response is the right response, even though they didn't plan it. So I'm just trying to make connection to something that you could have experienced or could have been aware of, that it is possible to have this kind of natural response. Now, to be in tune with God's will is a very exalted idea. It goes beyond the normal, but you could see that you could have the right response without having consciously planned it. Yeah.
Do you read the verses that not so much in the whole Kerush assumes that the first time comes before one becomes for the other? The verse, in simplest terms, says we will do and we will hear. It doesn't necessarily exclude the possibility of doing all that stuff simultaneously. And also, if, as Rashi says, there's not a time to power in front of the rock, maybe the order doesn't necessarily mean that one thing first. So how do we know that that's what it means?
Okay, well, first of all, I think that you'll have as much trouble with simultaneity as you will with one before the other. Can you really hear and do simultaneously? Surely there's a little bit of a gap. Not much, but it's not simultaneous. I took you at your word. If you meant simultaneous, it's going to be just as difficult. Furthermore, if you are going to talk about things that are going to be done, and because you speak a language and you don't say the words simultaneously, you have to say them one after the other, we assume that you will choose the most natural way of putting it, not a purposely unnatural way of putting it. So if you're, if someone is going to express his willingness to follow orders, and he says to the commander, "I will do everything and I will also read your orders," it will be regarded as very odd. What he should have said is, "I'll read your orders and do everything they say," not that "I will do and I will read the orders." It would be a very peculiar way to speak. Now, "Ein mukam luchar b'torah" does not mean things are a jumble. It means, if you are in trouble, and the only solution that you can think of is to say that things are out of order, it is an acceptable solution to a problem. But it is not an independent creative instrument of changing the order of things because it's something which, you know, leads to new insights or new social applications or whatever. So, and usually it refers to events. It doesn't refer to the order of words in a verse. Ein mukam luchar b'torah means that when you're dating events, you don't have to take them in chronological order, because sometimes it places a later event before a former event. I don't remember any case where it's used to reverse the order of words in a particular verse.
In the line in the Gemara, where we have the problem, why it doesn't switch from a noun form to a verb form, and instead the noun is more of its essence, why couldn't it have both words as the noun form, and you still have do being the essence?
Well, grammatically, you can have both being the noun form. So since the, and it's a verse quoted in the Gemara there, but it's a verse from, I don't know which one. So what it's telling you is that only doer is the noun, and listening is not the essence. The essence of an angel is not to listen to what God says. The essence of an angel is to do what God says. But as a doer, listening is part of what you listening is also required. It's required because otherwise you won't know what to do. But the listening is not essential. An angel is not essentially an audience for God's speeches. An angel is essentially something that carries out God's will and does it. So it's very precise. He is a doer. As a doer, one of his activities is to listen. But that's not what he is. He's not a listener. He's a doer. Just an example of how carefully you have to weigh verses or what Chazal say. If you would take the sum total of all of Hillel's output, all of his output, it would fill maybe 10 pages. I mean, that's all we have from a lifetime of scholarship. Ben Akiva's output, you know, 20 pages. That's all we have from decades of scholarship. So it means that this is the most refined, most essential ideas, and they're usually put in very brief form, which means that every word, every letter was counted and weighed and put there for a reason. And the shifting grammar, that's in the verse even. The shifting grammar is extremely important. So you ask the right question, but this is the answer. Listening is not what an angel is all about. What an angel is about is doing. Okay? All set? Okay.